Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of our program, Dare to be Different. It's just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming medium 1548 Satellite Islam, and to those of you who have the DAB Plus, we are on that particular platform. It's a trial run, and welcome once again. My name is Ismail Varyava, and we have something different lined up for you this morning. This morning we're joined by Tim Neary of Nature's Journal, and he's going to share so much information with us. The first one that we're going to be looking at is aliens and exotics in our myths.
Had an interesting discussion over numerous cups of coffee, and that was around the exotic animals or the invader aliens that we might have. Are they all bad, or are some of them good? And in fact, is what do we mean by these exotics? I guess if we wanted to be a purist, we'd know that we'd have to have an ever-changing landscape of the species that we grow, be it in our gardens or, of course, of the animals that we have surrounding us. But we don't. We're allowed to own, for example, exotics on most occasions. For example, we're not allowed to own a South African snake unless, of course, you have the required licenses and you are a collector, or maybe even a researcher. One of the comments I liked from a professor I know was quite simply to remember that all fauna and flora are in fact indigenous to the planet. We don't have alien and invader fauna and flora. I kind of like that one, because you get that feeling that the Martians will arrive tomorrow, maybe a meteorite or whatever, and salt the planet with some strange one-eyed cyclopses. But that's not going to happen. Effectively, we're looking at animals that don't occur in an area naturally. And for most of it, we seem to put those borders around a country, let alone a province. If we were to be realistic, we work our creatures, our fauna and flora, in the various biomes of the country. And we'd make sure that the biodiversity within those biomes is allowed to occur on a natural basis. That would also mean, though, that we'd need to accept that there'd be a certain change. Here we're talking about the evolutionary change. And no, I'm not trying to convince anybody that man comes from apes, or maybe our ancient ancestor was a dolphin. What I am talking about here, though, is the change that species have made over time to allow themselves to adapt to various conditions on the planet. Now, alien species aren't always bad, and that we see, for example, with the alien mussel that has come down onto our South African coast. Yes, it has caused a variety of issues on the rocks, but it's also allowed the oyster catchers to regenerate and sometimes move up our various coastlines. The changes, though, sometimes when we remove alien species is quite dramatic. And here, for example, we go down to somewhere like Port Elizabeth. In the early years, the sand dunes were shifting and continuously moving, as sand dunes do, and it was threatening to take over the city. And who knows, Port Elizabeth could have ended up looking like Coleman's Kop up in Namibia. Well, it didn't. The Crooks brothers walked across the dunes of Port Elizabeth, casting out the Port Jackson willow, which, as we know, is an Australian tree. Well, to confuse you even more, it is an Acacia saligna. No, don't even go there. It is yet again one of those Australian trees where the Australians have claimed the acacia name, and of course, which means with thorn, and the Port Jackson willow doesn't have any. Back to our issue around the Port Jackson willow. This was cast across much of the landscape, as was a railway line which went out over the dunes to allow the rubbish of Port Elizabeth to be spread over that area. That, of course, was an interesting and good thing in the end, because as a young person I can remember spending hours digging up all sorts of artifacts out of these tips and making a bit of pocket money out of them. I've still got Port Elizabeth gas taps, shingles and bottles that came from that area. But of course, the Port Jackson willow had a throttling effect, and that took out much of the natural landscape. It did its job, yes, we'll give it that, of retaining the sand dunes, but it also stopped any form of the Eastern Cape style fynbos that did grow just above the rocky areas. Well, interestingly enough, since starting to remove actively the Port Jackson willow, some of the creatures that have come back, besides, of course, the wonderful flora that you now see across that area, of course, the dassies have reappeared, as have a number of other small species of animal, and they are far easier to see. So at times, when we use exotic vegetation, we do have a knock-on effect to an area. Not only is that knock-on effect throttling of the other plants that would grow there naturally, but it also removes the foodstuffs of many of the natural creatures. Sometimes it also brings in additional creatures. For example, around that area, the vervet monkeys exploded because they could live happily in that Port Jackson willow. One of the issues that we do have, of course, with the exotics is the escaping that happens. So, for example, we're not allowed to have a South African snake unless you are a collector, as we've said, or maybe unless you are a researcher. But you can have an exotic. It's interesting to note just how many exotic snakes have been found in people's gardens. As our weather patterns have changed and we've got a little bit warmer, it means that our winters are not nearly as harsh, not only from an atmospheric condition, but also from the growth that surrounds us, which creates a far more conducive habitat to the survival of the exotic species. There are the fears as well, on many occasions, of the exotics breeding with our own indigenous animals, and thus resulting in hybrids. But I think we will need Johan Marais to chat to us on the Nature Journal in 60 Minutes about the problems that exist within the reptile world. Well, thinking about autumn at the moment, we're really starting to get our cold early mornings and late evenings, and one wonders what winter is going to be. So, do remember to make sure that you've got your wood all ready for your fireplace, maybe an odd bit of gas, etc., and hopefully you're not relying on electricity. Of course, we could have a couple of outages, power blackouts, call them what you want to, inconveniences. But of course, there are tons of folk across our country who still don't have the luxury of electricity. It's amazing how short our memories are, because many of us who are not that old most of you can remember growing up in houses where there was one toilet and bathroom, for example, maybe a slow combustion heater that was busy warming up the house, or of course even a small kettle that was heating up your water for your bath. We still have our kettle standing at our front door. It's something so far I have not got rid of. And I can remember as a wee lad, this thing sitting on a cement plinth in the bathroom. You had to open up the tap, toss in a few pine cones, a little bit of newspaper, put a match to it, and of course the water would warm up. And thereafter, every time you wanted a bit of extra hot water, add a pine cone or two, but of course no pressure relief valves at all, so you had to make sure it was running. I'm sure some of you will also remember the tomato box, which was sought after for our briarflaces. In those days, of course, tomatoes arrived in a box, as did a variety of other vegetables. And you may even remember, of course, we had things like wooden matchboxes. Somebody was saying to me the other day, what about the quality of our matches? Well, not even our line matches, I believe, are made in South Africa anymore. They all come from some eastern country. And, of course, maybe that explains why we have such poor quality. Well, do remember you can join us on Saturday morning between 8 and 9 a.m. where we will be broadcasting the Nature Journal in 60 Minutes. Also broadcast on channel 869, which is DSTV, as well as www.1485.org.za. The programs are also podcast. Well, from me, Tim Neary, have yourselves a super week. Well, I'm off next week to go and play in the rocky shores and the rock pools of KwaZulu-Natal.
And that was Tim Neary talking to us about aliens and exotics in our midst. We are going to go for a short commercial break. When we come back, stay tuned. If you just tuned in, my name is Ismail Briava, and it's just wonderful to have you tuning in, whether via the audio streaming medium of 1548 Satellite Islam, and to those of you that are, you know, both on the DSTV Bouquet 826 as well as on the DAB Plus platform. Many of you are still curled up in bed and some of you are around the breakfast table. It's just wonderful to have all of you tuning in. And this morning we've taken a different take, and we're joined by Tim Neary of Nature's Journal, and he's given some fascinating insights into different aspects. Tim is also going to be sharing with us thrushworm citizen signs, and we hope that you find it as useful and valuable as I did.
Well, looking outside the window while I'm recording the program, we've got a Karoo thrush who is tremendously busy at this point of time fighting an overgrown python. Well, the way that the fight is progressing, you would think that this worm is a python. Mrs. Cluck, etc. are sitting on the sideline, and I can just visualize there's going to be a second battle for the worm in the not-too-distant future. Well, on to queries, emails, photographs, etc. from listeners. I'm absolutely fascinated by one in particular, which is one on a hunting spider, also known as the rain spider. The hunting spider has been stung by a wasp, and in fact the wasp does this to enable it to lay an egg inside the spider. Once the eggs are laid, the wasp keeps the spider kind of alive, and it is a free meal for the youngsters to chew on. Well, the honorable house owner took one look at this little operation that was going on and rescued the spider. This has now been going on about 6 weeks, where she catches flies, feeds the spider, and slowly but surely the venom that the wasp put into the spider is starting to work its way out. The spider is starting to get a lot more movement, and I think this is going to be an interesting one to see what the end result is. Now, recently we met one of these confounded wasps dragging his spider through my workshop. This turned into being a particularly nasty occasion. I thought that the poor old wasp, a spider, needed to move itself outside, so I scooped them up and did just that. Well, this little wasp seemed to think that he was about the same size as an Apache attack helicopter, where he had me doing some incredibly interesting dances, I am told. Move across, Fred Astaire. Tim Neary is far more fleet-footed on his feet when you have a wasp aimed at certain parts of his anatomy. We then moved this wasp out into the garden in front of the bedroom. Well, about 2 or 3 hours later, while we were sitting at the briar place, sipping gently on my whiskey, puffing on my pipe, the wasp approached, dragging the spider. My son thought that this was a really good idea. What a joke, Dad, he thought, until the confounded wasp leapt into the air, turned itself into an Apache TAC helicopter once more, and cleared the decks. The humans all ducked. The spider, the dog, and the cat all appear to have some form of understanding. About an hour later, just as the sun had got itself behind the horizon and darkness was descending, said spider and wasp had been dragged into the garden. Where they went to, I don't know, and I can assure you, I wasn't going to look. Chatting to Duncan McFadden, though, it's amazing to see how much interest there is nowadays around bugs and beetles. Normally we would have rushed outside and sprayed whatever we wanted to kill everything in our garden, but there is that realization that bugs and beetles are good as well. Just because a plant's got a couple of eaten leaves doesn't mean the end of the world, and of course it is all part of the cycle of nature at its very best. Next week I'm spending time down at the University of Cape Town with the folk at the Animal Demography Unit. Now, the Animal Demography Unit is the unit that runs the virtual museums and the mapping systems. LepiMap, for example, which is the mapping system being undertaken on butterflies and moths. Then we have ReptileMap, where they are looking at a variety of interesting issues around different reptiles. Then also you've got things like Mammal Map, and Mammal Map is now going right across the continent and receiving incredible acclaim for the work that it's doing. And these are all part and parcel of the world of citizen science. I don't think we really appreciate just how much of a contribution citizen science makes to the world of science. We have the time generally as folk going out with an interest to look at the specific field that we are interested in, to collect the data, the GPS points, etc., and then upload all that information for the scientists to take them and look at the trends, the various species movement, etc., etc. And therein lies the value that we can put back in, just as citizen scientists. Recently I posed a question to a number of academics and asked them to please profile a citizen scientist for me. What is the demographic, the age, etc., etc.? And the reality was, we really couldn't, for the simple reason that a citizen scientist is anybody who really is outside of the field of recognized science. And equally, never underestimate the value that young folk put into this. I am absolutely amazed listening to Liesl's girls, who are 9 years old. The information they have, the observation they have, it is far beyond the age of nine. And really, because I suppose we don't sit and question them. We don't get to understand the depth of their interest. One of the questions so often raised, though, is how do I get the GPS coordinates that you're always talking about? Well, fortunately, some of the telephones have got the GPS coordinates as an automatic feature, as do a lot of our cameras. But the reality is, for most of the information that we can go to, we just need an approximate. And that's where Google Earth is really great. Of course, if there is, for example, a special butterfly that hasn't been seen for a century and you found, well, we need to be a little more accurate than kind of the Google Earth thumbsuck. We need to get right down to virtually the bush. But that, of course, once you know the approximate position, you can then go back and locate what you're looking at and get the correct details to make the mapping system all that more interesting. We spend so much time, though, on our world of conservation. We spend hours looking at the different mapping systems, creating stats and looking at the future planning of the conservation of a variety of species. But mostly, today we look at the conservation of the biomes, the conservation, the holistic conservation, in fact, of a given area. The one thing we do forget most times, though, is the people behind it. And here we enter with a program with Johan Buerta. Now, Johan is the gentleman who was on 50-50 for many years. Johan is an incredibly interesting man. And together with Dani van der Walt, who in fact started 50-50, we've got together and we're looking at the legends of conservation. We need to know more about the people that you believe are great legends in their life of conservation. Now, some of them are really obvious. The likes of the late Ian Player, for example, the late Nick Steele, maybe even going up into a variety of areas like the Waterberg, and talking to Clive Walker. Down to the coast we can go and find out more about turtles from George Hughes. These are really known people, but often not enough has been said about them. But there are also a variety of legends of conservation that we just don't know about. These can be folk who are farmers, maybe farm workers, guys who have worked as guides on reserves, looking after rhino in the early days. And these are the folk that we are now desperately looking for. So if you know of any legends in conservation that you would like to put forward, people for consideration, and we'll go and dig into the stories, well, please do contact me at tim@neary.co.za. That address again is tim@neary.co.za. I'll be only too happy to do that background research work. And who knows, some of them may even go way back to people like Baron von Ludwig, who was the namer of the Ludwig's Bustard and started our first botanical garden in South Africa, and in fact brought gas lighting to Cape Town, thus making the life of the elephant seal a lot safer. From me, Tim Neary, have yourselves a super week.
And our final segment is Life of a in a Commercial Plantation. And that's fascinating. It's a different take on this. Is what is life like in a commercial plantation? We all know about commercial plantations. We know that these are the people that produce our food. But what is life like for them? Whether it's potatoes, tomatoes, onions, whatever it is. They're out there, cabbages, and now that we're in the winter months, all our brassica family, they're busy planting, harvesting. And what is life for them in a commercial plantation? And Tim Neary is sharing some of that with us, inshallah.
Went down into the sappy forests, and we were doing some recordings and filming with Johan Buerta. Johan does a series for Sappy called The Thing About, and it's particularly interesting as one discovers a lot more about tree research, for example, and also about water usage by trees and a lot of information on the plant life that we see in our various forests. Also, though, a project that has been undertaken is camera trapping. Now, you do know that with the ADU, we look at a variety of their projects around mammal map, etc., and often the word camera traps are used. Now, camera traps are just simply a way that we can look at wildlife in an area without disturbing the wildlife whatsoever. So, a particularly fancy camera is bolted into a box, tied to a tree, and off we go. Well, the humans, of course, are rather interesting. The different things that are seen in the forests, the poachers possibly going off to go and do their business, and just people trotting past. Many cyclists as well are seen as they cycle down the various paths where the cameras are. There's a little bit of camouflage on the cameras. However, many of the wildlife, and of course the humans as well, do see them, and we get some pretty close and personal photographs coming out of those cameras. There is a vast number of interesting aspects. First of all, we do believe that forests are these completely clean green deserts. And here I'm not talking about the natural areas, I'm talking about the forests that are grown, the crops in other words. Well, anything from the truth. Bushbuck pop past for a little visit to the camera to see what's happening. And on one or two occasions, we even have the tongue of a bushbuck as they've decided to lick the lens and see what on earth is this creature on the tree. Of course, there's the daytime and the nighttime variations as well. Porcupines come and go at every corner, bush pigs, and of course, now we're starting to see a couple of warthogs appearing. Even there, for example, the warthogs tell a story. At the beginning of the camera trap being installed in this particular forest, we noticed that there was mom and three juniors. Obviously, mother has had enough of the kids, tossed them out on their own, and now we've got three particularly upset little hoglets who are walking around as sub-adults, not too sure whether they should be big, gruff hoglets, or, of course, little scaredy characters who need to disappear into the forest at every turn. Well, the interesting animals that are also seen are side-striped jackal, for example. Now, I've never seen a side-striped jackal, and this character is a little larger than our blackback and tends to look a little bit more like a wolf. What an interesting little guy he is, as he trots up and down with purpose, going from one to the other. Serval, civet, and of course those wonderful characters, the servals, they are such interesting guys as they go down the road with great purpose. That's one of the things that I find so interesting about this project. Many of the creatures that are walking down the road have got ultimate purpose in where they're going. It's not just a stroll off in the evening, but it, of course it is a scurry to go and find food. And of course, equally, I suppose we're going to go and visit our maybe girlfriend or boyfriend, and hopefully there'll be juniors in the future. But it is just so exciting to me to see somewhere around about 24 to 28 species of animals in a supposed clear green desert. It's anything but the truth. Of course, the challenge is now also going to be, how do we look at the little guys? And of course, the bird life, and that's usually seen by sound. Even there, there were some incredibly interesting little birds. And one of the things that fascinated me is lying in my bed early in the morning with the windows open and the curtains open, just as the sun was rising. Every morning, Mrs. Sunbird would come and hover in the window, and with her beak, she appeared to be collecting the spider's web that had been left behind the night before, all going, no doubt, into the nesting material. Talking of nesting, I do notice that the great nesting is continuing in the garden. As I woke up this morning in my own normal bed and looked outside and noticed that there's a great amount of activity. Equally, talking of activity, has anybody got a secret for me as to how to stop the mossies attacking the motor cars? All of the motor cars in the Neary household have all got socks on the side mirrors, and this is becoming quite an amusement to see what happens if you forget your sock. And, of course, within minutes, early in the morning, you hear that incessant pecking like a woodpecker. One of the other interesting aspects about the animals in these forests is that it does appear that they are a sink for all sorts of wild creatures. For example, brown hyena are being seen more than 100 kilometers away from their natural range. And one wonders, 5,000 hectares of forest, is that just the great place for you to go and live? And of course, there are the natural areas in the waterways, etc., dispersed throughout the whole forest. And does that make life really great if you're a wild creature? Not a lot of people in there at all, because of course, once it has been planted, it is just maintenance that takes place. And therefore, if you are somebody who is wild and woolly, I guess it is a lovely place where you can live your life without being interfered with by all sorts of humans. Interesting to see, though, there is a great amount of poaching that takes place in all sorts of areas, unfortunately, as we get closer to people. And that, too, we see in places like the Magaliesberg. And I do believe that the leopard story that we spoke about on the Nature Journal in 60 Minutes is a typical example of that. One of the other little creatures that we met while we were in that Nottingham Road area was the dwarf chameleon. Now, there is a cute little character. Well, coming up in this week's Nature Journal in 60 Minutes, going to be chatting to Johan Maree about all things slithery and snaky. And I think this time we're going to be looking at snakes that aren't venomous. And we had a wonderful time with Johan the other day at a birthday party for a bunch of nine-year-olds. And that, of course, is with Liesl's girls. That was a lot of fun. We're going to be finding out about the world of pangolins, because it is International Pangolin Day. Jerome Ainsley is going to be chatting to us about the usual ADU Citizen Science Day that will be taking place up in Pretoria. And then we're also going to be discovering about a frog experience. This is a different one. This is going to be a Guinness World Record attempt, so do listen out for that one. You can, of course, join us on DSTV channel 869, as well as www.1485.org.za. Well, from me, Tim Murray, have yourselves a super week, and we'll catch you again next week.
Finally, that's all for me, inshallah, until we meet again. Jazakumullah, assalamu alaikum, jazakumullah for tuning in, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.